Good morning, everyone. Today we are going to introduce Sefer Mor Nevuchim. In the last shiurim, we saw how the Rambam maintains that there's an obligation to try to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the extent possible, and that philosophy plays a role in doing so. So, the first question we have to ask before studying philosophy is, when can someone study philosophy? What are the prerequisites? The Rambam writes that studying philosophy or philosophical topics prematurely is problematic, not just because you won't be able to understand it if you're not properly prepared, but because it could cause you to misunderstand some of the most essential topics. It's also important to stress that the Rambam understands that a correct conception of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is essential, but at the same time that could be achieved without studying philosophy. Philosophy is important in that it helps you prove things, but you could know things even without the study of philosophy. So the basis of these prerequisites are found in the Gemara in Chagiga, in Daf Yud Aleph Amud Beis, where the Gemara says that you can't teach esoteric topics publicly, lest someone not understand them. And even among worthy students, there must be individual attention given to the students. And especially when it comes to Maisa Merkava, there is an additional requirement. Besides making sure that the student is being taught individually and that he's at an appropriate stage where he's able to understand it, it's necessary that you only convey the material through Roshei Prakim, meaning to say that the student must independently extrapolate the concepts and not be taught them explicitly. Maybe we'll talk about a little later why you can't teach these things explicitly, but those are the basic requirements. And the Rambam incorporates these both in his introduction to Mor Nevuchim as well as in Mishneh Torah. We'll read it in Mishneh Torah. It's on page 14 in your source books. Tzivu chachamim harishonim shelo lidrosh bedvarim elo, elo ish echad bilvad, v'hu shiachacham umevin midato. So first of all, it has to be one-on-one. The student has to be a chacham. V'achar kach mosrin lo roshei haprakim. In other words, like we said, even at that point, you could only teach the roshei prakim. You can't teach everything explicitly. U'modiyan oso shemetz min hadavar. And he'll be able to figure out everything on his own based off of these Roshei Prakim. Bedvarim elu dvarim amukim heim ad lema'od ve'en kol da'as ve'da'as ru'uya l'sovlan. These matters, meaning the first two chapters of Mishneh Torah, Maisa Merkava, are very deep. Not everybody is capable of understanding them. V'alein amar shlomo b'chachmaso derach mashal etc., etc. Later, at the end of Perek Dalet, he returns to the restrictions. Prakim Gimel and Dalet are Maisa Bereishis, as opposed to Prakim Aleph and Beis, which are Maisa Merkava. And he writes, Kol dvarim ha'elu shedibarnu b'inyan zeh, kemar midliheim, v'dvarim amukimheim, aval einam ka'omek inyan perek rishon v'sheni, meaning to say Maisa Merkava is more amok than Maisa Bereishis. Uvir kol elu advarim shebeperek shlishi v'vi, hu anikra Maisa Bereishis, v'kach tzivu chachamim ha'shonim, she'en dar shegam b'dvarim elu b'rabim, el adem echad bilvad, modim dvarim elu umalam demoso. And therefore the restrictions for Maisa Bereishis are a little more relaxed. Uma bein inyan Maisa Merkava l'inyan Maisa Bereishis, what's the difference between the two? She'inyan Maisa Merkava afilu l'echad ein dar shen bo, Ella im kain hayachacham umevin midato nosin lo roshi aprakim. When it comes to Maisa Merkava, even with respect to one person, they can't be taught explicitly. V'inyan Maisa Bereishis milamdim oso liyachid. Whereas when it comes to Maisa Bereishis, you can in fact teach them to a yachid. You could be explicit. Afal pishein umevin oso midato, even though he can't independently extrapolate them. Umodiyan oso kol shiachol leida midvarim elu. V'lama eim alamdin oso berabim, but even Maisa Bereishis can't be taught publicly. Why not? L'fi she'en kol adam yesh lo das rechava l'hasig perush uvi or kol advarim al boyan, because not everybody is capable of understanding them. Vinyane arba prakim elo shebechamesh mitzvos elo hem shechachamim arishonim korin osan pardes. So these first four chapters of Mishneh Torah are what the Chachamim refer to as pardes. And about these, we have five mitzvos, as we mentioned. Kemosha amru arba nechnasu lepardes. V'afal pi shegdole Yisrael hayu v'chachamim gedolim hayu lo kulam haya behen koach edo lahasig kol hadvarim al boryad. We see the danger here. It says that there were four chachamim that nechnasu lepardes, and of course only one emerged unscathed. Now, these people that entered pardes were chachamim gedolim. They were great people, and yet the effects of their venture were very, very deleterious. So we see here the danger. Interestingly enough, the Rambam writes that not all Chachamim are capable of studying Pardes, not all the Tanaim and Amoraim. Obviously, the Rambam felt that he was capable of studying Pardes. But the point is, and we'll see this a little bit more later, that different people have different intellectual capacities and predilections and the like, and therefore not everyone should pursue this path. So the first thing is that before one studies pardes, one has to fill their stomach with meat and bread. In the Hakdamah to Moreh Nevuchim, he says bread and wine. The lechem ubasar zeh, what is that? Leida biur ha'iser v'hamutter ukiyote ben mishar mitzvos. To know that which is aser and mutter from all the mitzvos. V'afal pi shedvarim elu davar katan karuos chachamim. Even though lechem ubasar, meaning halacha, is called davar katan, as we saw last time. Shereyamu chachamim davar gadol ma'isim erkava davar katan havayos v'vay v'rava. So even though they're only davar katan, they should come first. Why? Shein miyashvin daito shel adam tchila. They settle a person. They teach you how to think and the like. When you see people that teach Kabbalah or the like or philosophy without having been grounded in Shas and Poskim, you oftentimes find very weak understanding. Va'od shehem hatova gdola shishpia kadosh baruch hu liyishuv ha'olam hazeh. Meaning to say, mitzvos are the great gift that God gave the Jewish people for the settlement of this world. The Rambam thinks that primarily mitzvos are meant to create the perfect society for Yishuv Olam Hazeh, and Olam Hazeh is very important because it's only in Olam Hazeh that we can be worthy of Olam Haba. So therefore, it's important that halacha precede philosophy, because as we said, Olam Hazeh is perfected through halacha, and Olam Hazeh is the means, kidei linchol chai Olam Haba, is the means through which we get Olam Haba. V'efshar shiyedem hakol, moreover, it's important because everyone is capable of understanding that. Gadol v'katan ish v'isha, ba'alev racha v'ba'alev katar. Everybody could understand halacha, whereas not everybody could understand Maisa Bereishis and Maisa Merkava. So the first question we have to consider is what exactly is meant by lechem ubasar? How much do you need to know? So there are different opinions. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman in Kobit Shurim in Chelek Beis, Perek Mem Zayin, section 9, writes that lechem ubasar means shas uposkim. So a person essentially has to know, have mastered shas and poskim before going on to study Maisa Bereishis and Maisa Merkava. And that's one of the reasons why he writes that nowadays it's not really feasible for anyone to study Maisa Merkava and Maisa Bereishis as defined by the Rambam, because we have not achieved that level. Others, though, say no. Lechem ubasar doesn't mean mastering shas uposkim. Rambam says leidas aser vesamutar. You have to know basics of halacha. Doesn't mean you have to have mastery over halacha, and therefore the bar is not as high. Additionally, many point out that not all aspects of Maisa Merkava or a philosophy are negeder of Latayel Bepardes. The Araktana on that Rambam writes that these comprehensive prerequisites apply only to Latayel Bepardes, only to Maisa Merkava, but it doesn't necessarily apply to studying and understanding the basic principles of faith and the like. So we need not put everything into one category. Now, it's also important to stress that mastering Shas Uposkim in and of itself is not a sufficient prerequisite to guarantee success. We know that Elisha ben Avuya was surely someone who had mastered Halacha, Shas, Poskim, whatever you want to call it, and yet entering Pardes caused his downfall. And thus the Rambam writes in his introduction to Mar Nevuchim that in addition to being well grounded in terms of exoteric wisdom, a person must have Yir Shamayim. He quotes the pasuk Sod Hashem Li Reyav, that the Sod Hashem of Maisa Merkav is only possible to be understood by Li Reyav, and thus perhaps an even more important prerequisite for the study of Maisa Merkava is Yir Shamayim. The next issue we need to deal with is the extent to which we can actually understand God. If there is a mitzvah of Yediyas Hashem, of trying to understand God, is that something that's truly possible? So the Rambam writes, after discussing the inaccuracy of a corporeal understanding of God, he writes the following in Perek Aleph Halacha Yud of Yesodei HaTorah, page 15. Mahu zeh shebikesh Moshe Rabbeinu lahasig, kesheamar hareini nas kavodacha. We know Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu, hareini nas kavodacha. What exactly was he asking? Bikesh leida amitas himatzo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ad sheyia yadua belibo kemo yediyas echad min ha'anashim shera'a panav, v'nechkeka tzuraso belibo, shenimtza oso ha'ish nifrad bedato mishar ha'anashim. He asked to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the truth of his existence, to the point that it was so clear it was like when you see a person and recognize them. Kach bikesh Moshe Rabbeinu lios mitziyuso, mitziyus HaKadosh Baruch Hu nifredes belibo mishar nimtzayim ad sheyeda amitas himatzo kasher hi. Veshivu Baruch Hu she'en koach ba'ad adam ha'chai Shumechubar miguf v'nefesh lahasig amitas davar zel borio. As long as we're alive and we are comprised of a body and soul, then we are limited. We can't understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence. We can't understand, we can't reach that very, very deep level of understanding HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And even Moshe Rabbeinu, who at Har Sinai reached a level where he almost entirely superseded the limitations of his physical body. He didn't eat or drink for 40 days. The Rambam understands that not eating and drinking for 40 days isn't simply a miracle. It was a reflection of his having gone beyond the physical limitations that restrict or inhibit a normal person. And yet, even having reached that high madrega, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to him, well, you're still mechubar with a guf and a nefesh, and accordingly, this level of understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is impossible. So that is one of the reasons why the Rambam writes that the tzaddikim and the chachamim, like David HaMelech, longed for Olam Haba. In Olam Haba, when, according to the Rambam, there's an entirely spiritual existence, so a human is there, is able to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a way that's impossible as long as he's on this world. Ve'hodiyu Baruch Hu ma shelo yada adam lefanav lo yada l'achrav. So even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe that he can't fully fulfill his request, he taught him things that no other person had ever known and will ever know. Ache hisig me'amitas himatzo davar shenifrad HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'dayto mishar nimtzayim. And thus Moshe's understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is different, was superior to all other beings. Kamo shipared achad min Hashem shera'a achorav v'sig kol gufo u'malbushav b'da'ato mishar gufei anashim. So it wasn't quite what Moshe asked, but just like you could have a certain recognition of a person if you see him from behind by seeing his clothing and the like, that was the recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that Moshe achieved. V'aldavar ze'ramas ha'kasav amar v'ra'isa ha'chorai u'panai lo yera'u. So it goes without saying that as finite creatures we can't understand an infinite creator, and we are especially limited as long as we're attached to our body. And there's another issue that we have to consider here, which is that the Rambam frequently stresses God's incorporeality, and there's a danger when one relates to God in such an abstract manner. And the danger is that it will limit our ability to emotionally connect to God. This is, in fact, one of the reasons why the Torah refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu with positive attributes and even physical descriptions. These are false. Certainly the physical descriptions are false. But even the positive characteristics, calling HaKadosh Baruch Hu Rachum, Chanun, Gadol Gibor, Nora, and the like, are actually false. We'll discuss a little bit later why they're false. But the Rambam believed and argued that positive characteristics are a contradiction to God's oneness, to his unity. If they're essential characteristics, then there's something besides him, and even if they're inessential, then they certainly contradict Achdus. We'll talk about what that means a little later. But why is it then that the Torah refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in these terms if they're actually false? So one reason, the Rambam writes in Mor Nevuchim, why the Torah refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in physical characteristics is that for many people, especially people at the time of Tanakh, coming to an understanding and belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu that was totally incorporeal was impossible to do all at once. And therefore, because humans naturally think of things that are physical as being more real, I'll say, like, I saw something and it was real as this table, right? So the truth of the matter is that's false. Things that are physical are in a sense less existent and true than something that's non-physical to a large degree. But nevertheless, for many people, it was the case that they couldn't come to an understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to knowledge of God's existence, unless God was described physically. And thus, the Torah speaks of God in physical terms. A, they should be understood not as referring to God as physical terms, and much of the first 50 chapters of Mor Nevuchim are all about how certain words used by the Torah shouldn't be understood as perhaps would seem at first glance. They actually have a different meaning and don't imply corporeality. But why would the Torah then use such misleading words? Meaning to say, okay, it's true if you understand what these words truly mean, they're not referring to God's physicality. Fine. But why speak in such a misleading word? And the Rambam understands that these types of vocabulary, these types of words, serve in a sense as a double entendre. Meaning to say that the correct understanding doesn't imply corporeality, but they would be understood commonly as indeed referring to God's corporeality, and this would bring people to a correct a belief in God, which could then lead them to grow out of that incorrect understanding of God and come to truly believe in the incorporeal God. So that's one reason for the Torah's descriptions of God in physical terms, and also using positive characteristics. When it comes to positive characteristics, there's also political value. We'll get to that later. But another reason, and especially for this, for referring to God in these types of terms, is because it's not just enough to believe in God and philosophize all day. You have to have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And referring to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in these types of terms is something that sets up that relationship. And if you totally relate to God in this abstract way, there's a danger that a relationship is impossible. And this is a number of the Rishonim say this is also one of the reasons of for Dibra Torah Kilashun B'nei Adam. Dibra Torah Kilashun B'nei Adam is what we mentioned before, that the Torah speaks in human terminology and even speaks of God in human terminology. The truth is that when Chazal used the term Dibra Torah Kilashun B'nei Adam, they're referring to language issues like repetitive phrases like Ganov Yiganev or the like. However, the Rishonim, including the Rambam, Rabbeinu Bachya, Rabbi Yehuda Levi, and others, all understand Dibra Torah Kilashun B'nei Adam in the way that we are referring to, which is, for example, anthropomorphisms, speaking of God in physical terms. And this is necessary because it ensures that we have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If you look on page 16, Rabbeinu Bachya puts it after describing HaKadosh Baruch Hu in very abstract terms, he says, V'kevan shiganu adhena midvarenu, ein sorech levar inyan hazeh yoser, mipnei she'anu chayavim lirhos v'lira v'lihizaher mimenu. And I think what he's saying here is the point that we're saying, that it's necessary sometimes to think of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even in false terms, in order to have this relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Rav put this in very stark terms. The Rav said that he doesn't even understand why the Rambam was even bothered by the question of why does the Torah refer to God in such terms. After all, it's obvious. This is in the Worship of the Heart essays in Jewish prayer. He writes, I never felt sympathy for Maimonides' horror at religious sensual portrayal, because it's obvious that these types of portrayals are necessary to build the type of relationship of Ava and Yira and the like that we have for our HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, there's a danger when relating to our HaKadosh Baruch Hu in such an abstract fashion, which is often the case during philosophy, while studying philosophy, that this relationship not be formed. So, if we can't understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence, how can we understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So the Medrash writes, also on page 16, Vayomer Elokim el Moshe, Amar bi Abba, Bar Mamel, Amar le HaKadosh Baruch Hu le Moshe, Shmiya ta mevakesh leida, Lefi maasai ani nikra, Pamim shani nikra, Bekel Shakai, Bitzvakos, Be'elokim, Be'Hashem, Shani danes habriyos, ani nikra Elokim, וכשאני עושה מלחמה ברשעים, אני נקרא צבקוס. וכשאני תולה על חטב של אדם, אני נקרא כל שקאי. וכשאני מרחם על עולמי, אני נקרא השם. The Medrash is saying that despite HaKadosh Baruch Hu's absolute unity, we perceive HaKadosh Baruch Hu differently at different times. So, sometimes we see HaKadosh Baruch Hu one way, and sometimes we see HaKadosh Baruch Hu another way. And that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu answers Moshe, how should you call me? Akasher Akal, be that which I will be. Meaning to say, you can't understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence. The only way in which we could understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu is to study the way in which he relates to the world. We could only understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu post Bria, as it were. How he relates to us, so that's how we could understand him. But his essence, fundamentally, is beyond our ability to comprehend. The Nefesh HaChaim puts this as follows, also on page 16. Amnam inyan habracha lo yisbarach shemo, ena kavana la'atzmos adon yachid baruch hu kaviyachol, chalila v'chalila, ki hu miromam me'al kol bracha, aval ha'inyan kamo shekasav bezohar, de kutshebrichu sachim v'galya, ki atzmos ein sof baruch hu sasim mikol stimin, ואין לחנוס או חס ושלום בשום שם כלל, אפילו בשם הוויה ברוך הוא. There's actually a debate about that, whether Havaya reflects his essence or not, but the Nefesh HaChaim is assuming that when it comes to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence, so he can't be depicted in any way, and no name can relate to that, ואפילו בקוצו של יודבי. And then he says, ואף גם ma shebezor kadosh mechanehu yisporach b'shem ein sof. So, even though the Zohar refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence as ein sof, einenu kinui alav yisporach shemo, ela kavana al hasagasenu oso mitzad kochos hanishbayim meito bischabruso birtsono lo lamos. Even that only reflects the way in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu is mischaber to the olamos. Meaning, again, like the Medrash said, we can't understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence. All we could understand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the way in which we perceive him, the way in which he relates to the world. Ulezos kinu ein sof velo ein reishis. Ki be'emes ein mitzad atzmuso yisbarach shemo ein lo lo sof velo reishis. Rak mitzad hasagasenu ko chosav yisbarach halo kol hasagasenu hu rak reishis. Aval ein sof lagia ba'asaga la'asig es ko chosav yisbarach hanishpayim. Uma shemusag etzleinu k'tsas vanu mechanim umitarim kama te'arim v'shemos v'kinuyim umidos kemo shematzinum b'torah uv'chol matbea tefila kulam hem rak mitzad hischabruso yisbarach el haolamos v'akochos me'eis habriya. So whenever we describe HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whenever we relate to him, whenever we study him and the like, we are not understanding his essence. What we're understanding is the way in which he relates to the world. The way the Nefesh Chaim puts it is Me'ez Habriya. We're understanding HaKadosh Baruch Hu post-creation. Now, there is no difference between HaKadosh Baruch Hu post-creation and pre-creation. He's the same. But we could only understand him as he relates to us. And that's what he means. We could only understand him post-creation. He didn't change, but he's at least perceivable on some level post-creation. The Rambam even writes that referring to HaKadosh Baruch Hu before creation is totally inaccurate, because time didn't exist before creation, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu wasn't limited by time. And these natural limitations, these ideas we can't understand, relate to things that exist outside of time and the like, are a reflection of this limitation on our part. And this tension is most apparent within the writings of the Rambam. The Rambam writes, on the one hand, that love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the basis of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is dependent upon our knowledge of him, and at the same time Rambam stresses the limitations of our ability to understand him. Just for example, the Rambam in Parak 58 on page 617 on your sources, praised be he who at the moment that the mind's glance at his essence, their understanding turns faulty. At the moment of glancing at the necessary correlation between his will and his actions, knowledge turns into ignorance. When the tongues attempt to exalt him with attributes, all verbosity turns into ineptitude and faultiness. So we longingly try to understand him, to draw close to him, and when we finally arrive there, we realize how far we actually are. And that's why the Rambam writes that the greatest praise of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is silence. David HaMelech said, Lecha dumiyah tehillah. To you, praise is silence. Why? Because whenever we praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we're being inaccurate. We're saying things that are, technically speaking, false. And therefore, we strive to get close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to understand him. And the more we understand of him, the more we realize that we don't understand. The Nefesh HaChaim writes that this tension exists in every single bracha. That's why we refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the bracha as Nochach and Nister. And many thinkers write about these two aspects, these tension, our desire to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to come close to him, and also our recognition that we can't, and that's impossible. In fact, the Mishnah Chagiga writes that there are four things that a person can't consider: malamala, malamata, malafnim, and malachor. And the Ramchal writes that these four things fundamentally reflect the prohibition against trying to comprehend and to contemplate his essence. And therefore, whenever we are thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we always have to recognize that we're not really understanding HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence. We're simply only understanding the way in which he relates to us and that which we could perceive. The next thing we have to consider is the prohibition against going too far. Ben Sira is quoted in the Gemara as saying, "Bemuflam imcha al tidrosh, uvemechusam imcha al tachkor." The Rambam writes that there were those who made terrible mistakes by trying to go too far. In fact, at Har Sinai, HaKadosh Baruch Hu warned the people that even though they were about to experience an unparalleled revelation, don't go too far into your understanding. The pasuk when it says "Vakohanim va'am al yaharsu la'alos el Hashem pen yifrotz bo" is saying, "Be careful! Don't go beyond your capabilities." And the Rambam writes that the godless of Moshe Rabbeinu was that he didn't go too far. In fact, even when he was first given the opportunity to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so it says, Vayaster Moshe's panav kiarei mehabit el ha'alokim. What does that mean? The Rambam writes, that means he understood that it's inappropriate to try to go too far, to push beyond his abilities, and therefore, Vayaster Moshe's panav. And precisely because of that humility, because he understood that he can't go too far, he was zocha to end up going farther than anybody else ever did. The Rambam writes the following analogy to this question. It's a bottom of page 17. You must consider when reading this treatise that cognitive perception, because connected with matter, is subject to conditions similar to those which physical perception is subject. That it is to say, if your eye looks around, you can perceive all that is within its range of vision. If, however, you overstrain your eye, exerting it too much by attempting to see an object that is too distant for your eye, or to examine writing that's too small, so your eyes will become weak. Essentially saying that just like if you try to see something that's too far away, or read print that's too small, you're going to ruin your vision, so too, if you try to understand something beyond your limits, so then you will ruin your mind. We talked about earlier, though, the danger in the other direction, which is that a person shouldn't say, well, I can't understand this anyway, so I shouldn't even try. And here, as we saw the Ramban powerfully say, only idiots think that way. And that while there are significant dangers to going too far, nevertheless, one has to be very careful not to limit themselves too much and not to fail to accomplish what they're able to accomplish. Oh. So, considering all the limitations that the Rambam writes about teaching philosophy, how could he write the Mor Nevuchim? And this raises a very important question. How do we read the Mor Nevuchim? The Mor Nevuchim is a book that was written that could be read by anybody once you write something, so you can't control who the reader is going to be, in which case it would seemingly be a violation of the Gemara in Chagiga that says Maisa Merkava could only be taught one-on-one. So how could the Rambam do this? So the Rambam addresses this challenge in his introduction to Mor Nevuchim, and he writes, but I rely on two precedents. First, to similar cases that our sages applied the verse, Eis Lasos Lashem Heferu Sarasecha. So the Rambam writes in his Hakdama to Mishnah Torah that the truth of the matter is it's usher to write down Torah Shebal Peh. However, Reb Yehuda Nasi saw that if the Torah Shebal Peh was not written down, it would be forgotten. And therefore, Eis Lasos Lashem Heferu Sarsecha, sometimes you're made for the Torah L'Kaimis HaTorah. And so too the Rambam writes, I am going to do what's technically speaking usher, namely write Maisa Merkava, Maisa Bereshis. But if I don't do this, the dangers of it being forgotten or people going astray or the like are also too high. And therefore, it's a necessary step that must be taken. Then the Rambam writes another justification. Secondly, they have said that all your kol masecha yu l'shem shamayim. What does he mean by that? He says, on these two principles I relied while composing some parts of this work. So, it's very interesting. The Rambam in Igeres Teiman writes at length about how it's absolutely usur, based off of the Gemara, to be machashiv es haketz, to predict when the ketz is going to be, to make calculations. And the Rambam then turns to an obvious question, which is that Rav Sadia Gaon, among other great people, but Rav Sadia Gaon did in fact calculate the ketz. How could Rav Sadia Gaon do this? It's usur. So the Rambam writes that basically his two kavanos were as follows. Number one, something along the lines of Eis Lasos LaHashem, he saw that the people at the time were losing their faith in the coming of Mashiach, and if he didn't write it down, they might lose hope. And second of all, he was Mechavein L'Shem Shamayim. He writes, verily, all his deeds were for the sake of heaven. Consequently, in view of the probity of his motives, which we have disclosed, one must not decry him for his messianic computations. This might relate to the fact that the Rambam, in that very same letter, after writing how bad it is to be Mechashev Ezaketz, is Mechashev Ezaketz. We'll talk about that a little later, why he did that, and whether what he did was technically considered a ketz, or just a ketz concerning the restoration of prophecy. It's a different issue. But the Rambam's justification that he says that Sadia Gaon had, so in a certain sense he applies to himself in writing the Mo'en Nevuchim. Number one, Eis Lasos LaShem. Number two, I'm doing this L'Shem Shamayim. And finally, number three, he writes the following. There's a third factor. Lastly, when I have a difficult subject before me, when I find the road narrow and can see no other way of teaching a well-established truth except by pleasing one intelligent man and displeasing 10,000 fools, I prefer to address myself to the one man and to take no notice whatever of the condemnation of the multitude. So this is something that, of course, the Rambam was predicting accurately, that some of the things he would write would get him into trouble, as they did. And he said, that's a risk I'm willing to take. More important, I prefer to help the intelligent person and save him from his embarrassment, even if it's going to cause a lot of controversy. In fact, he writes, very fascinatingly, that one of his solutions to the isser of teaching esoteric matters publicly is that he's going to write them cryptically. He's not going to be explicit in his intentions. In a moment we'll see he's even going to intentionally introduce contradictions. And if he were to write the things explicitly, so that would surely be usur, but since he's writing them cryptically, then that's okay. And he says, how do I know that's right? Well, I'm just modeling myself after HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in describing the creation of the world, used allegorical, figurative, and metaphysical language, meaning to say, Perek Aleph of Sefer Bereishis does not really give you any clue, if you understand a kipshuto, as to what actually happened. The way the Rambam writes it is, he described those truths, profound truths. We're on, what page are we on? 18? We're on, we're on page 20, towards the bottom. Sorry, the previous sources were above that. I'm reading where it's underlined. He described those profound truths, namely Maisa Bereishis, which his divine wisdom found it necessary to communicate to us in allegorical, figurative, and metaphorical language. And the same thing is true when, with respect to my presentation in Mo'en Nevuchim. So don't read it too literally. What emerges is that figurative language and imagery, according to the Rambam, serve three separate purposes. Number one, sometimes imagery clarify and concretize obscure matters. A mashal helps me understand something that would otherwise be too abstract. I give a mashal, and it will help me understand it, concretize the matter. Sometimes it's meant to do the exact opposite, to obscure an esoteric matter so that unqualified individuals won't study it. And finally, number three, to allow something to be understood on multiple levels. in order that the uneducated may comprehend it according to the measure of their faculties and the feebleness of their apprehension, while the educated person may understand it in a different sense. Just like the Torah could be understood on many levels, Keneged Arba Banim Dibra Torah, and some understand it on one level, and a deeper person could understand it on a deeper level. So by using things like imagery and the like, the Torah communicates a message on multiple levels, and therefore could be understood differently in different ways. So as I mentioned, the Rambam, in this context, discusses the idea of contradictions. The Rambam writes that there are seven types of contradictions that are found in literary works. And these seven types of contradictions could be divided into two classes. Numbers 1 to 4 consist of apparent contradictions that stem from a misunderstanding of the author's intent, meaning to say they're not actually contradictions, but they just seem like contradictions. So, for example, sometimes what would seem to be a contradiction would be the author quoting one opinion in one place and somebody else's opinion in a different place. Or he first quotes a theory which he subsequently rejects. Or the passages aren't meant to be taken literally. It seems like a contradiction only when understood literally. If you understand the true intention of the author, there is no contradiction. Or the fourth one is that the premises are not identical in both cases. And he writes actually that the Mishnah and Tanakh employ these four types of contradictions. So, for example, the Gemara will frequently resolve a contradiction by saying statement A was made by X, statement B was made by Y. That's the first cause. Or sometimes it'll say, oh, he changed his mind. That's a second reason. Or sometimes it'll say, no, don't read this literally. If Dvarim Kiksavim, it's a contradiction, but it's not Kiksavim. And so on and so forth. What about causes 5, 6, and 7? Those are real contradictions. Now, sometimes these contradictions exist because they escaped the attention of the author. That's number 6, meaning to say, I contradicted myself because I didn't notice it. Number 5 and 7, though, are intentional contradictions. And the Rambam writes that in this work, in Mor Nevuchim, the only contradictions that result are the result of design, number 5 and number 7. Now, why would a person ever intentionally contradict themselves? Reason number 5 is because things must be taught in steps. Sometimes you can't understand things. Lamashal, you know, you teach when teaching physics, so you teach Newtonian physics first, and then later on you teach relativity. And you couldn't really skip straight to relativity, even if it's in a sense more accurate. So too, things have to be taught in steps. And that's why sometimes you'll find in my work, I'll say something, and then later on I'll say it a little differently. You wouldn't be able to understand the second statement without having first understood the first statement. And then finally, reason number 7 is what we alluded to before, that since there's a prohibition against teaching esoteric matters publicly, so I'm going to insert intentional contradictions so that the person who's unworthy of reading my work will see the contradiction and dismiss my work. He'll say, look, this thing doesn't make any sense anyway. It's full of contradictions. And the person worthy of studying the work will understand my true intention and figure out what my true opinion really is. So that's why he inserted contradictions, again, to overcome the halachic restrictions of teaching Maisa Merkava publicly. Now, there was an unintended consequence of this strategy, and that is that the true intention of the Rambam has been debated on many matters ever since the writing of the Mor Nevuchim. What did the Rambam really hold about, let's say, Hashgacha? Even Ibn Tibbon, who lived at the time of the Rambam and translated his works, writes to the Rambam asking how to resolve certain contradictions concerning Hashgacha. He had a very interesting theory how to do it. The Rambam famously wrote him back and said to him, I'm too busy, I don't have time to talk to you, so don't bother traveling here. So, because there are these types of contradictions, it makes studying the Mor Nevuchim very difficult. And in fact, when you look at some of the commentaries on Mor Nevuchim, you'll find different schools of thought as to how to deal with this. To sort of overly simplify, there are three schools of thought. Sometimes these are known as the esoteric commentators, and they're both medieval ones as well as modern ones, and they sort of hold that any statement that the Rambam said that seems frum, he didn't really mean. That's sort of an oversimplification. But by frum, I mean contradicting Aristotle. And they say that, well, when he said these things, he said them to please the masses so he didn't get in trouble or all sorts of other reasons. But really, he means the opposite of what he actually said. Now, the problem with this is, first of all, it allows you to make up whatever you want in the Rambam. But second of all, it ignores the Rambam's explicit introductions as to how to read his work. He writes also in the introduction, I adjure you, any reader of my book, in the name of God, not to add any explanation to a single word. Seems to be telling us, don't offer these far-fetched interpretations. Don't add interpretation. On the other hand, at the same time, the Rambam also writes in the introduction, should the reader notice any opinions to which he does not agree, let him endeavor to find a suitable explanation, even if it seems far-fetched, in order that he may judge me charitably. Maybe that's an example of a contradiction. I don't know. But one way or the other, the Rambam does tell us to be careful not to insert too much into what he says. I think there's a bigger problem that usually emerges from these types of understandings, which is that they fail to look at the Rambam holistically, and they favor certain parts of the Rambam while ignoring others. Rav Kook writes in the letter that people oftentimes look at the Rambam and they see him in a very narrow sense. They're narrow people, so they see Rambam as a narrow person, and they interpret him as such. The Rambam was very broad, and when you read some of the things he says, you're amazed that the same person that seems like this dry philosopher could say such emotional things when you read his statements in communal leadership or his love or all sorts of things. And it's important, for example, when studying Mor Nevuchim, not to forget about what he wrote in Mishneh Torah. Again, sometimes it's complex, but seeing it holistically, seeing the Rambam holistically is something very important. Others take the opposite approach. Instead of saying that everything frum that he said he didn't mean, they say everything fry that he said he didn't mean. Right? We saw last week there are some thinkers that that say, well, all these controversial things that the Rambam said, he didn't really mean either. They're essentially following the same approach. The Rambam says things he doesn't mean, so we'll assume that he says what we think. And finally, the approach that we're generally going to take is, for the most part, to accept Rambam at his word, and when there are contradictions, we'll have to try to resolve these contradictions, but not in a way that ignores one of his statements, but in a way which allows us to see both statements as not being at odds with each other. A couple minor other points. We mentioned that the Rambam refers to Maisa Bereishis as a science. And one could ask the following question. If Maisa Bereishis really means science, as we understand it, why is it that the Gemara has such high understandings, such high limitations on the teaching of Maisa Bereishis, right? That you can't teach it publicly, it has to be one-on-one. It's true they're not as high as Maisa Merkava, but if it's simply science, for example, what's wrong with teaching a science to a class? And the answer is that when we look at the way the Rambam presents Maisa Bereishis, it's quite different than the way we nowadays perceive of the natural sciences. The Rambam understood Maisa Bereishis as the means through which we see God in our world. And you see this in a number of places. For example, the Rambam describes the spheres and the celestial beings, like even the sun and the moon and the stars, as being these sort of quasi-living beings that contemplate and understand God. He writes, Kol HaKochavim VaGalgalim, this is in Yisodei HaTorah, Perek Tes, Perek Beis Halacha Tes, Kol HaKochavim VaGalgalim, Kulam Balei Nefesh, V'deya, V'haskel Heim, V'heim Chaim, V'omdim U'makirim Es Mishamar V'haya HaOlam. Likewise, in his understanding of Tzuros, the Rambam also has a theory of forms. He refers to Tzuros in many places, especially Perek Dalet and Zion in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah. So the Rambam believed in these non-material abstract forms. These forms, though, are very different than, let's say, Plato's theories of forms. The Rambam's understanding of Tzuros, Rambam writes that these Tzuros are Tzuros HaKadoshos VaTahoros. Now, Plato's forms were also aspatial and atemporal, but they were certainly not holy. The theory of Tzuros is part of Maisa Bereishis, it's part of understanding the world. And we see from these examples, as well as others, that the Rambam's understanding, what he referred to as Maisa Bereishis, or the physical sciences or the like, had a much more spiritual content than I think the way we usually look at science. Parenthetically, I saw a very fascinating thing in Emes Liakov, Al HaTorah. He writes that when he watched a man first walk on the moon, Neil Armstrong, so his first thought was, whoa, that schlugs up the first four prakim of Mishnah Torah. Because they're not the entire first four prakim. Certainly the Rambam's understanding of celestial beings being non-physical things. So he said, well, he wasn't so sad because according to the Ramban, when the Chumash refers to Shamayim, it's not referring to the moon, it's not referring to the sun, it's referring to the spiritual heavens. And he said that at that point when he saw man walk on the moon, he apparently went to go watch it. The neighbor's TV. So he realized that at that point the Mekubalim triumphed over the philosophers. One way or the other, though, you see that the Rambam's understanding of the physical world is probably quite different than the way we take to understand it. The Ran in Drashas HaRan goes even further. He distinguishes between Maisa Bereishis and what we call science. He writes, this is in the first Rasha, Hine lefize Maisa Bereishis hi chachmas hateva ha'amitis, lo osa sheyitfalsu bo ha'mischakmim. Maisa Bereishis is the true chachmas hateva, not what the philosophers are talking about. Essentially what the Ran says is that Maisa Bereishis is the spiritual dimension behind physical things that could only be known through revelation. He writes, "Ef shar shiodeya or shivada ki im b'shefa eloki nevui." Now, it seems difficult to say that the Rambam fully accepted that, because the Rambam writes that many aspects of Pardes were known to him through non-traditional sources. Right? For example, in Mor Nevuchim, in his introduction to the third section, he writes that I came to these conclusions together with the philosophical principles that I have adopted from other sources. So, it's hard to go as far as the Ran, who says that all of Maisa Bereishis, according to the Rambam, are things that are known through tradition. But it is true, as we've seen, that that there is a spiritual element. In fact, when the Gra writes that the Rambam didn't know what Pardes was, he writes that it was because it was, as the Rambam says, it was shaped by Greek philosophers, right? Who, that which the Rama says is Medivri HaRambam, and Avalo Ra'u Es HaPardes Lo Hu, meaning neither the Rama nor the Rambam. Now, if you actually look at the Kobet Shiurim, he uses the Ran to, it's Kobet Shiurim Chelek Beis Simen Mem Zayin, he uses the Ran to defend the Rambam from the Gra's critique. I guess we're almost out of time, but the Gra's statement brings us to an important, last important thing we'll talk about today in the Rambam, which is the Rambam's attitude towards Kabbalah. So the Gra said, Lo ra'o es ha-pardes, that the Rambam, true Pardes is Kabbalah, and the Rambam never saw it. And to some degree, he's probably correct. Now, it's not the case that the Rambam was never exposed to things like Kabbalah. It's hard to imagine he'd never heard of it. Rosh Ad Yagon wrote a commentary on the Sefer Yetzirah, for example. Oh, it's not a, it's more of a philosophical commentary, but still, he was aware of the Sefer Yetzirah. In fact, he himself refers to a Kabbalistic work known as Shir Koma, which deals with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's height. In Rambam's youth, he thought it was a genuine work that was written allegorically. Later on, he changed his mind, and in the later introduction, later editions of the introduction, he crossed out that reference. There's a tshuva, it's quoted in page 578 of Rav Shelat's Igros HaRambam. He writes that he never thought the work was written by Chazal and the book should be expunged. But the Rambam clearly was aware of certain aspects of Kabbalah. Nevertheless, he didn't have a particularly favorable view of them. There are those, parenthetically, we'll talk about that disagreed. If you look, for example, in the Migdal Oz in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, he writes that Hu ba'atzmo yodea ki derech ha'emes ne'lemes ve'inim seres ela mipel pe'u v'chashai. And he writes about how the Rambam didn't know Kabbalah. There's a famous, again, another forged letter written to Rabbi Yosef ben Yehuda. Rabbi Yosef ben Yehuda was the person who he wrote the Mor Nevuchim to. Mor Nevuchim was like a letter written to this person, this struggling student. And there's a later letter written for him. It's also quoted in 695 in Rav Shelat's Igros HaRambam, in the section of the Igros that are not by the Rambam. But anyway, he writes there how later in life he came to realize that you shouldn't study philosophy, you should only study Kabbalah. But the pashtus is that the Rambam thought Kabbalah didn't make a lot of sense. And the truth of the matter is that that really comes from the fact that the Rambam, if you don't have a Kabbalah for Kabbalah, meaning to say you don't have a tradition, so one would naturally and should naturally dismiss it. If you read Kabbalistic texts literally without having received the tradition as to how to properly interpret them and without knowing that they're not meant literally, so naturally a person with proper amunos fideos would dismiss them as being heretical. They speak of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's features and his size and his characteristics and the like. And the Rambam didn't have that Kabbalah, meaning say he might have seen certain texts, but he didn't have a Kabbalah that it was MS. And naturally then, when he saw those texts, he dismissed them as being heretical. A couple more things, but I guess I'll stop with one story. So, when a number of years ago, my wife and I are both teachers, so we decided during the summers to go to a number of communities to give shiurim over the summer. First year we went to Las Vegas. Second year we were married, we went to Edmonton, Alberta. And so I prepared a number of shiurim, and then I asked them, you know, what shiurim would you like to hear about? So everybody kept on telling me, oh, we should learn Mor Nevuchim. So I was a little taken aback. I'd never heard of anyone really studying Mor Nevuchim nowadays. So I asked them, why are you so interested in Mor Nevuchim? So they told me, oh, because we hear a lot of shiurim in Mor Nevuchim from this fellow. His name is Ezra Bavli. Some of you might know his sons. They learned here. So Ezra Bavli was someone who wasn't at all religious or observant, and somebody asked him a little bit about something concerning Jewish philosophy. He realized that he didn't know anything about Jewish philosophy, but he remembered that there's this book of Jewish philosophy called Mor Nevuchim, so he decided to read it. And sure enough, he read Mor Nevuchim, and he became frum. He was compelled, and he was so excited about Mor Nevuchim that he taught it to other people, and they too became excited about it and motivated and inspired, at least until I started teaching Mor Nevuchim, then they lost a little interest. But it's really, it's a sefer that's not studied so much anymore. And I don't necessarily think it should be at the top of someone's list. But it is something that has a tremendous amount to teach and to learn from. And when you learn it, you won't be surprised that someone could read the book and become frum from the book. if they have the patience to if they have the patience to work on it. All right, have a good Shabbos, and we'll pick up next week. That's just a show.
Thank you, guys.